It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Early voting starts today in Wisconsin. A little later, we'll find out what early voters need to know so their votes get counted.
First, while polls show widespread support for expanded use of renewable energy in Wisconsin, the reality may not be keeping up with expectations. The state appears to be lagging when it comes to solar and wind power in particular.
Bill Leaders joins us now. He's a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. His recent piece on renewable energy appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, tell us the story behind the story. What led you to tackle this issue?
Well, there are a couple of things. I was contacted by a reader who said that he had been to a presentation and he saw a very dramatic chart, which I then tracked down. And what the chart shows is that if you look at Wisconsin and the United States in terms of new solar electric installations, it's going up pretty gradually throughout the 2000s. You get to 2010, and suddenly the U.S. Line shoots straight up. There's just been a tremendous explosion nationally in the number of new solar installations, but the Wisconsin line starting in 2010 goes downward. And it's rebounded a bit in 2013, but it still has gone down and it remains lower than it was in terms of the number of these new electric solar installations coming online. So it's a fairly dramatic graphic, and I pursued it as a topic through the perspective of a business person who is involved in solar energy. And the person I picked is the head of the state association for solar energy. It's Matt Newman, who is a self-described conservative. He's the son of Mark Newman, the former Republican congressperson from Wisconsin, who was one of the original founders of that business.
And a while back, there was talk of the potential for various forms of alternative energy as a possible growth industry, forgetting the environmental impact. It seemed like Wisconsin was maybe going to make a play to be a leader in the industry. Did you get a sense from Matt and some of the other research that you did of why it hasn't moved in that direction?
Well, there's one big thing, and that's that Wisconsin utilities were asked to meet a particular threshold for the amount of electricity that they obtain from renewable sources. That threshold is 10%. The utilities have already met that. The deadline for it is next year in 2015, but the utilities in Wisconsin have all already met that threshold. And so they don't have the same incentive to keep on investing. They've reached the goal that has been set for them. That is a factor that was cited. I spoke today with an individual who's involved in solar installations who talked to me about the projects that his company is doing in other states. A half dozen other states, they've done major projects in this last year. Nothing in Wisconsin. There is no major wind project that is scheduled to happen in the state of Wisconsin. One of the reasons for that is the utilities are not motivated to go beyond the goal that they've already met. Another interesting thing about the Wisconsin experience in that regard is half of all of the energy that utilities are getting from renewable sources in order to meet this mandate, half of that is coming from other states. It's being purchased from other states. It's not being generated here in Wisconsin.
Did you get a sense from talking to Matt Newman and others that this is a missed opportunity in the state?
Exactly. That's how they see it. They think that solar in particular has now evolved to a place where it is cost effective, where it no longer even needs government subsidies in order to make economic sense. But what Matt Newman said is it still needs for the laws to facilitate the industry to help it grow. There's a particular concern among solar providers that they feel that they cannot, given the ambiguity of Wisconsin law, they cannot engage in these third-party agreements. That is, come in, build a solar system on somebody's home or business, own that system, and then charge the person for the electricity it generates. That's what is done in a number of other states. It's not being done in Wisconsin because the law is ambiguous. Some of the utilities, one of the utilities has gone to the PSC and wants expressly to make these arrangements more difficult to allow the utilities to cut off service to people who engage in these sort of arrangements so they can't buy energy when, you know, their generation is low and they can't sell it back to the grid. What Matt Newman said was, you know, we need the law to change. We need for there to be clarity that you are allowed to have these type of arrangements, and then companies like mine could go in, don't need any government help, don't need any subsidies. We just need the law to change, and we can start doing these things here.
So that's a new arrangement to me. I kind of assumed that you either buy power from a utility or you slap some panels up on your roof. In the scenario you're talking about, maybe I own a shopping mall, and I bring in a third-party company.
Yes.
They cover my mall in solar panels, charge me for the energy I'm getting from my roof.
Yes.
And then in the winter, on the dark days, I pay my local utility, you know, to bring in power.
Exactly.
And other states are doing this.
Other states are doing it. And I believe that Matt Newman told me that the majority of solar power is set up this way. This is a very common arrangement. It's just not happening here.
So what would have to change in terms of laws to make that happen? Is it, you said it's a gray area. It's not necessarily illegal, but is not clearly legal?
Yeah, there's some ambiguity in the laws to whether a company that does this would be considered a utility subject to all of the regulations mm-hmm. that utilities are subject to. And again, a couple of utilities have asked the PSC to make some changes in rate structure and systematic changes which would erode some of the incentives for buying alternative energy, at least in the minds of the critics. That's an issue that you've covered and others have spoken about. And within there would be a particular proposal that would kind of codify that companies cannot enter these third-party arrangements without some consequences.
Well, let's get into that wider issue, the possible rate changes. As I understand it, the concept is, okay, consumer, we're going to raise your monthly fixed cost. You're going to pay a higher amount each month for the tap, in effect, but we're going to lower the per unit cost. And so renewable energy advocates are saying, hey, this is a disincentive to use alternative energy.
Right, because you're no longer being rewarded for using less energy. More of your cost is based on being a customer and not on how much energy you use.
Now, we've been mostly talking about solar and wind here. How about biomass? Are we doing more with that than maybe other states are?
I believe so. Biomass, and then we have these biodigesters, which are springing up in various places around the state. I reached out to the office of Governor Scott Walker with regard to this issue because he has been criticized by his Democratic opponent for not doing more with regard to renewables. Mary Burke has said she would be much more aggressive in pursuing renewables, biofuels, biodigesters. And the response that I got from his spokesperson was actually a very detailed and thoughtful response, which said, you know, you're asking in particular about solar and wind power. If you really want a full picture, you should look at the range of things that we're doing, and pointed to a number of things that the Walker administration has done and is doing to facilitate the growth of biomass in particular, biodigesters, and more broadly, energy conservation. There are a number of incentives that have been created to promote energy conservation efforts.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Maybe Wisconsin doesn't have the competitive advantage over other states in wind, and certainly not in sun. We've got some biomass here at Wisconsin coming from our farms and dairies.
That's right. And, you know, the governor at one point early on disparaged wind power, said that this was a very inefficient way to get energy. And one of the very first things that he did as governor was to propose some rules that made siting wind turbines more difficult. They had to have a larger setback than even what the PSC had proposed after it engaged in a multi-year process to come up with new rules. The governor wanted a setback. You can't have a wind turbine unless, you know, it's a quarter mile away, I believe, from the nearest property. And that was seen as, you know, very detrimental. A number of planned wind power operations pulled the plug and gave up. There was a loss of actual dollars in investment in that industry here in Wisconsin. And in fact, in the last 2 years, we have not had any significant new wind power added in the state of Wisconsin.
We're talking to Bill Leaders about his recent piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at renewable energy and why Wisconsin might be lagging behind the rest of the country. And you could join the conversation.
Do you think Wisconsin should make bigger efforts on renewable energy? Why do you think the state has been slow to adopt wind and solar? And where should biofuels fit into the picture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about renewable energy in Wisconsin with Bill Leaders from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. In a recent piece, he finds that the state is lagging in renewable energy, especially wind and solar.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin should raise its threshold for the amount of energy that has to come from renewable sources? Would you like to see more wind power in your part of the state, or do you think that it should be further away from residential areas? Not happy to see new turbines going up in your area. Do you think the state should do more to promote renewable energy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Bill, earlier you mentioned that threshold, 10%, which the utility companies have met in part by importing energy from outside of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Is there support for the idea of raising that threshold, requiring more renewable energy in the state?
Well, it depends who you ask. Clean Wisconsin did the survey, and it showed overwhelming support for renewable energy. The vast majority of respondents said they wanted to see greater use of solar energy, greater use of wind energy, greater use of biomass energy. I think it was 73% of the respondents also said that they believe that the state should increase its portfolio standard from that current 10% to 30%. I'm not sure what time frame they were asking about, but other states have done this. Minnesota, for instance, has set a goal of 17% of electric power generated by utilities coming from renewable sources by 2016, and it will raise that again in 2020, and it will go up to, they want 25% of the electric power coming from renewable sources by 2025. So in some other states, they have asked that utilities continue to get a larger share of the energy that they sell from renewable sources.
We heard from Mike on Facebook, who said, I think our state should make a push for renewables. We're looking at solar panels soon down the road for our house. Is that a common story, or are a lot of people putting solar panels on their residences?
I think so. I mean, we have seen actually a decline in the amount of solar installations in the state of Wisconsin, which includes the home installations. But the panels are getting more price efficient, and the power source is getting more competitive. It is now more economically feasible to do this. And again, the business person I spoke to said, we don't even need government subsidies anymore. We don't need the government to come in and give tax credits, which it still does, to people who choose this form of energy. We can sell our product based on how efficient and economical it is. We just need the law to be clear enough that people can buy our product.
Go to our callers now with Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that I've read recently that Wisconsin's considered sort of a no-go zone for alternative energy as far as investors and regulations and things like that. That's not a favorable state for that sort of activity. And in our state, where I live in Chippewa or Dunn County on the border of Chippewa County, there's a lot of frac sand mining, and they do locate those in residential areas. In fact, outside the village of New Auburn, there's three facilities, and they're like a quarter of a mile upwind from the elementary school in New Auburn. I think that's and they won't do a study about it, a scientifically based study about the effects of all this fugitive dust, and I think it has a negative effect on our economy also, because no one wants to live your strip mining activities.
All right, Willem, thanks a lot. So he's comparing, it sounds like, the frac sand mining, which he sees as being relatively unregulated, to things like wind power, which have seen, as you mentioned, Bill, bigger setbacks required between residential and wind turbines.
It's a very interesting point. My organization, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, has done a lot of reporting about the boom of the frac sand mining industry. Wisconsin leads the nation in terms of producing the sand that is used for fracking. And it's true. I mean, the DNR does not have the staff that it needs in order to regulate as thoroughly as it would want. There are some additional people coming online, the governor has said. And there are some concerns about the health impacts that have not been explored to the satisfaction of many local residents. And then you have wind power, where one of the primary arguments against it is that people don't like to live near these wind turbines, that the shadow flicker that's caused is disruptive. People get headaches. They don't like it. There are a number of alleged health consequences associated with this industry, and that seems to have a lot of weight, that you have the Realtors Association weighing in a big way in favor of these setbacks and these restrictions, which make wind power, frankly, more difficult to happen here.
Caller Daniel in Georgetown just dropped off the line, but said, hey, would massive solar panel fields be more palatable to people than wind farms? Do you think that would be an easier sell to a realtor or a homeowner?
I don't know. I think that with every new technology, there are going to be people who don't like to see it come in their backyard. And there'll be pushback on that front. I do think, though, it is an interesting point that the other caller made, is that those concerns seem to have more weight when it comes to solar and wind power than they do with the sand mining industry, which a lot of people also don't like. But to a large extent, they're told that, you know, that's the way it's going to be.
All right, we'll go back to our callers now with Mike in Northern Illinois. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the fact that I think there really should be a push for a higher threshold on the renewable energies, simply based off the fact that energy resources like fossil fuels, they're expendable, and regardless of whether there's an abundant supply of it now or there was an abundant supply, it's going to be expended, and it's really important to get off of that track and push for something that we don't have to rely on in the future when it's going to be completely expended. So, you know, if you could just expand on that a little bit.
Mike, thanks for the call. Is that an argument you're hearing from people in the industry that we need to get this stuff in place now for maybe when natural gas isn't as cheap as it is now?
Well, I mean, that's the traditional argument in favor of renewables, is that, you know, fossil fuels are a finite resource and we have to wean ourselves off them and develop alternative sources. And, you know, I think that's a very familiar argument. What I found kind of interesting in the people I spoke to most recently for this column is they're not really getting into that argument in a big way. They're saying this is a way that businesses can expand in Wisconsin. This is a way that we can create new jobs. This is a way that we can grow our economy. This is an economic opportunity that we're missing out on.
Is there a notion that somebody else is seizing that opportunity, and when we finally do get to the table, we might be too late?
Well, yeah, obviously, yes. There are other states that are doing more than Wisconsin is in some of these areas. And the fact that half of the threshold of renewables that the utilities in Wisconsin are obtaining to meet their goal is being purchased from other states shows that, yeah, that it means that some of our money is going to people in other states who are doing more in this area.
To another caller now with Jerry in Mellon. Jerry, hi.
Hi. On solar, people that are going to put that in, if they have to have a survey done, say they live in a wooded area, I had to clear out a bunch of trees, but the bill was over $500 for the survey, and will you give me a receipt that I had it done so I could get the credit from the state. They said, no, you'd have to turn that in or get permission before you have it done.
Gotcha, Jerry. Your line's not great there, but the gist, I think, that the economic incentives in place from the state government to put in solar is kind of hard to get. We've heard that from another caller today, too. I don't know if that's something you're familiar with,
I don't know very
though.
Much about that, but yeah, I every time that government is involved in providing subsidies or trying to mitigate this, it creates a layer of complication. I think that the advocates I spoke to are looking to a future in which the industry is supported just based on its economic good sense, not because government is coming in and putting its foot on the scale.
And briefly, those advocates, are they optimistic that even though things are going slow now, they might pick up in the next three,
yes.
5 years?
Yes, at least Matt Newman was very optimistic. He thinks that conservatives in particular are going to come around to realizing that this is an economic opportunity that the state of Wisconsin should seize and not continue to miss out on.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Bill Leaders, reporter of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. His piece on renewable energy is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the outgoing artistic director of American Players Theater looks back on his 23 years at the helm of what's been called the best classical theater company in America.
But first, early voting begins today in Wisconsin. It means you have until next Thursday, October 30th at 5 o'clock if you want to cast your vote in the November elections ahead of time.
With recent court decisions over certain elections laws like voter ID making waves, the rules surrounding early elections might be a little confusing.
Here to help us understand the rules of the road to ensure our votes are counted is Kevin Kennedy. He's the director and general counsel for the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Can I start by correcting you right away?
Please do.
Friday on Halloween, October 31st, is the last day that in-person or early voting will be permitted.
Well, I was confused because I assumed anybody voting on Friday would be in costume.
Well,
sorry, I did have that wrong.
Still count.
Okay. Well, now, give us the basics. How does early voting work?
Basically, early voting, and it's really just a form of absentee voting, is you go to your municipal clerk's office. You fill out a short form saying, I want to vote absentee. You get a ballot. You mark it. It gets sealed in an envelope that you sign, and the election official at the early voting site signs, and it's then delivered it to the polling place on election day and processed just like any other absentee ballot.
Okay, so that's we can do that one stop at the office. We can also still absentee vote by mail, is that right?
That's right. Now, that's where your Thursday deadline comes in. If you want an absentee ballot mailed to you, and you could have been asking this for weeks now, the last day to ask to have that mailed to you is Thursday, October 30th.
Now, how many places are there where we can vote in person? What kind of places can we go to do this with the early voting?
Well, there's really only one place in each municipality. So there's 1,852 places, but in Madison and Milwaukee, that's one place. The city clerk's office in Madison, and there's an alternate site in Milwaukee at the Seidler Center right next door to City Hall. But each municipality has one place where it can be done. Our law doesn't allow multiple places. So there are long lines in our larger cities as a result of that. Milwaukee is always busy. I often vote early in Madison because I'm a little busy on election day. So I stand in line. I probably will go do that next week sometime.
Now, wherever we are in the state, is there an easy way to find out where to go to place that early vote?
There is, probably, and it's a good thing to go to for anything election-related, and that is you go to a website that we put together called myvote.wi.gov, and you type in your name, your date of birth. It will tell you what municipality you're in, and you can get the clerk's address. You can also find out, am I registered to vote, so that you're prepared. And you can look at the candidates that are going to be on the ballot, the names of the candidates and referendum questions that will be on the ballot for your election. So it's a nice one-stop place to get a lot of information. And it's not unusual that people, if they're living in a suburban area, they're not quite sure what their municipality is. Their mailing address might be Milwaukee or Appleton, but they might live in one of the adjoining municipalities.
Now, to be very clear, do we need an ID to get a ballot for early voting?
You do not need an ID to get a ballot. If you're not registered, you will have to provide proof of residence and fill out a registration form. That often, the best piece of proof of residence is usually your driver's license if it's current and it has your name and address on it. But you can also use utility bills or property tax statements or rental agreements for that. But that's only if you're not registered or if you're registered at a different address and you need to update your registration.
And the same thing is true, right, if we actually want to vote on Election Day but haven't registered?
That's correct. Wisconsin is very good about making sure that you're not closed out 20 days before the election or 30 days before the election. We allow you to update your registration or register for the first time either in the clerk's office or at the polling place after we close our regular registration.
Now, you mentioned the deadline for early voting, the end of this month. Can we vote on weekends this year?
No. This is one of the changes. The early voting in the clerk's office is limited to weekdays, and the hours are between 8 in the morning and 7 at night. But a lot of our smaller municipalities may not be open those full set of hours. They may be open because it's a part-time clerk, or they might even be open by appointment. But you can't vote before 8 or after 7 unless you're standing in line at 7 o'clock, and you can't vote on weekends.
Now let's go to some Election Day voting. I know you just put out a press release today, and one of the bullet points is why we might consider waiting until Election Day, not voting early. Why is that?
Well, other than when the polls open or about the time everybody's getting off work, Election Day can be a pretty easy visit. If you show up, you know, say after 9 o'clock in the morning, before 4 in the afternoon, it's not unusual that there's no waiting at all for voting. And if you make arrangements with your employer, you can get time off of work, not guaranteed to be paid, to provide for that convenience. I mean, our early voting process, our absentee vote by mail, and the idea that the polls are open for 13 hours on Election Day is to provide people with the opportunity to vote.
Now, a point of curiosity, if I do early voting or an absentee vote, how do you then make sure that I don't vote again on Election Day?
Well, we have a statewide voter registration system where we track whether or not people have voted or cast their ballot. And the municipal clerks mark the poll lists that are used at the polls on Election Day as whether or not the person has applied for and cast an absentee ballot.
Now, talking about Election Day preparation on your side of things now, not so much from the voter perspective, with the off-again, on-again, off-again voter ID law, have you had to switch gears since the last time I talked to you and change things for local elections offices now that voter ID is not required?
Yes, we have. No question about it. We've been going forward, going backwards, going forward, going backwards. You know, a lot of it was really trying to make sure that we were eliminating any references to an ID requirement because it gets confusing. We even had a clerk call us the other day, and when we went to call her back, her voicemail said, "Don't forget to bring an ID to the polls." She had cleaned up her website, but not that. But we had to redo a lot of the materials that we give for training to the poll workers to take out references to ID. For example, people who are unable to enter the polling place because of a disability can have the ballot brought to them in their vehicle. And, you know, before that we had a step in there about ID. We had to make sure we took that out of the instructions.
And there was a question about people who had already gotten absentee ballots before voter ID was reinstated and trying to catch up with what had to happen there. Are those still somehow in limbo now that voter ID is back off?
They're not in limbo. We tried to make sure that they didn't think that it was a wasted effort. We directed the clerks to make sure they sent a letter to the people who had already received an absentee ballot, letting them know that even though we told you that ID was required and your ballot may not be counted, ID is no longer required, and if your ballot is returned, it will be counted with or without ID.
And Kevin, can you give us another plug for the website where people can go for all that Election Day, pre-Election Day info you mentioned earlier?
myvote.wi.gov.
All right, Kevin, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob.
That's Kevin Kennedy. He's Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board. If you've enjoyed a play, Shakespeare or otherwise, at American Players Theater in Spring Green over the years, you may want to stop and tip your hat to David Frank. He's been at the helm of the company as artistic director for 23 years. The company was in debt and producing four productions a year when Frank took over for two of the departing founders.
Today, the company is operating in the black, puts on around nine productions a season, and has been called the best classical theater company in America by the Wall Street Journal.
David Frank is wrapping up his 23rd year at APT with a production of Alcestis. Frank is retiring this month. Brenda DeVita takes over for him as artistic director.
David Frank is with us now to look back on his 23 years with American Players Theater. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, take us back to that first day that you hoofed it up that famous hill at American Players Theater to start the process of applying for artistic director. What do you remember about that day and the first play you saw?
Well, I have a story that I've told so often that I'm afraid that everyone's already heard it, but it is emblazoned in my mind. And that first visit, I was there for Sunday matinee, a matinee. It must have been 95 degrees. It was extraordinarily hot, and the reek from the porta potties was almost visible as it wound its way down towards the expensive seats. And you'd have thought that most human beings would have paid the full price of a theater ticket not to be present. There were 400 or 500 people sitting spellbound to a production of Winter's Tale, from which not one word had been cut. And I thought, this is the most extraordinary phenomenon I have ever seen. It is true, the stage is wobbling, and the premises are fairly primitive, and there's no money in the bank, but what a precious inheritance that was.
And you just come down from a big letdown in not getting that same position, artistic director at Oregon Shakespeare. And there you were at APT with the porta potties and a theater company that needed some TLC. What was it like? What was your mindset going in? Did you feel like you'd been booted to the minors?
Well, you know, no, I really never. I took one look at this place and I thought, oh, I want this job so badly, and felt supremely lucky to get it. It was obvious that there was some, you know, you had to crawl before you could walk, and we had to cut costs and all those kind of things. But it was just Madison, that audience, some of the actors we inherited. It was all so promising, so exciting, so capable of rapid change. We were just agog to get on with it. Yeah, there were practical problems, but they were all seemed capable of solution.
Now, you had wanted to be an actor yourself. How did you wind up a director?
I wanted to be an actor for a very short time. I trained long enough to convince myself and everyone else surrounding me that I was not going to be God's gift to the stage. you know, way back in drama school. But by then, the bug had already bitten deeply. And there was a little voice always outside me looking at me going, Frank, you're really bad. And that is a guarantee of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you know you're bad, you certainly will be. But what was, I just loved looking at what other people were doing and could hardly contain myself from saying, why don't you try? What if we did? Way back from drama school, I thought that's what I want to do. Now I've just got to figure a way of having someone let me do it.
So what were those early years like when you took over? I mean, APT has changed so much over the years. Right. From those first years, you got the job, obviously, as artistic director. What was it like in the beginning for you?
Well, you know, it was insanely exciting and hard work, of course, because, okay, every actor is going to be in every show. We've got to cut costs at whatever we do, and we've got to produce as many plays, maybe even more. It's the old simple formula, isn't it? Increase income, decrease expense. There was such a response from audiences. There was such a response The very first thing I remember we did, because there wasn't much money to travel, so you had kind of one audition trip, but we basically went out to a rather fine training program, which, alas, I think doesn't exist anymore, but did at this time. It's one that had its origins in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, then went to Newark, Delaware. And we essentially hired the graduating class of highly trained young actors, non-equity, inexpensive relative to their talent and ability, and seated those with the equity actors, chosen equity actors we'd inherited from the company. So it was really exhilarating, feeling the expansion, getting a sense of the audience that we had inherited, and also the ideas that we had inherited from the founders. That was the critical inheritance, which was that these plays, properly done, in and of themselves can be exciting to a contemporary audience. They don't need messing up. They don't need, you know, rotating stages and huge, heavy-handed concepts that are essentially making a boring experience more acceptable. If you just do the plays and tell the story well and, above all, make the language clear, they work. And Madison, of course, was the perfect place for that kind of proposition, because it's highly educated, well-read, and there were lots of audience members who came out to see those plays. We had no sets to speak of. Very costumes we largely rented or reused stock if we had it. Borrowed, we'd make a little bit, but not a whole lot. But the basic idea worked, and that was thrilling.
Now, you mentioned language, and you have a reputation for working really deeply with language, with crystallizing the meaning in it and being attuned to that element in particular. How has that bending toward language shaped what APT is?
Well, I think it really has. You know, in a way, I suppose it was a nice byproduct of poverty. When you have nothing else, you have the play, you have the actors, and that play is a story and those words. And that's above all what you have to do. Telling a good story is, of course, common to any production of any play of any kind, but you better do it. And then you have to deal with all those words, those dense verbal texts, which are the specialized area of concern for APT. And I'd always been fascinated with what the potential of adding the kind of rather technical background I came from in terms of verse speaking and phrasing and the mechanics of the voice and the mechanics of verse speaking, along with the kind of spontaneity and excitement and freedom that you detected in American acting. And often you were taught that there was a compromise between the two. You did that or that, and you tried to forge a middle path. And I always thought, no, I want to put it a slightly different way. I don't think it's a compromise. I think you fuse the two, that technical skills, if they are achieved at a high enough order, are actually incredibly freeing because they wither away. If the technique is good enough, an actor isn't conscious of it. They can just play the thought. But then also there was a way of trying to approach the poetry and to... this is getting complex and technical. but it was passionately important to us to try to make an approach to the verse that was specific to us. It doesn't mean it's unique. It's just that's what we wanted to unify the company around. That's why we wanted a permanent company, so that everyone could get on the same page as to how we approach dense verbal text. And the product of it should be that those complex verse becomes necessary, not just pretty, but a vital way of communicating, and that you can share your excitement with the language with an audience right there.
And
that has been the center for us.
And you've been with this company for 23 years. You must have so many stories about it. I wonder if you have one or two brief stories that are special to you that you'll remember.
Oh, my gosh. You know, you never know. What story? Well, I mean, it was a bit of one of the early ones I remember here, because I was asked that question quite some years ago about what the stories you remember first coming here and how was it different from being outdoor, from the indoor theaters that I'd been solely occupied in before. And I remember an early rehearsal of A Midsummer Night's Dream outdoor, and we were rehearsing on the stage. We didn't have many other places. It was a very hot afternoon, even in June, and we were rehearsing. And that Val Lantz, wonderful actress, she got married and went away and had children and all sorts of other career things, but she was a terrific actress, loved her, and she was playing Helena. And the scene called for her to be lying down in the woods, which was on the stage. And we got to the end of that scene, and I said, okay, hang on, let's gather for a moment, talk that through. And Val was still lying there. And then there was a squawk from Val, and her plastic earring had melted and bonded.
Oh, no.
But that wasn't the surprising thing. What was surprising was everyone took it in their stride as if it happened the whole time.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
They quickly cleared it. Oh, that's old hat, David. You haven't seen anything yet.
Wow. So lots of things happening in APT that you could probably fill a book with it. And, you know, we only have a little bit of time left here, a few seconds. Is there a Shakespeare line about goodbyes that comes to mind as you prepare to leave?
Oh, you know, I haven't prepped that one. There's so many lines, aren't there? But hopefully it's not a real good, you know, I'll be back to do a show next year, just one show, and I'll be around in the background in my walker urging on. There is a...
And I'm sorry, we're out of time. I have to leave it there, David, but it's been a pleasure to talk with you, and I wish you luck. David Frank is the outgoing artistic director of American Players Theater.